Okay. We were talking about lymphatics on Friday. We're going to finish off with the lymphatic section today. And then we're going to move on to venous return and then special circulation. So we just talked briefly about the structure of the lymphatics, how the system is pervasive throughout the body, and it runs into most organs. The heart actually doesn't have a very well-developed lymphatic system, but most organs in the body do. And we talked a bit about the structure and how the structure allows it to be run by pressure gradients, and the pressure in the interstitial space drives fluids and proteins in to these blind ends of the sort of capillary-like ends of the lymphatic system, and then eventually they get propelled towards the thoracic duct and into the central circulation. So the movement is the differential pressures between the outside and the inside lymphatics and between different regions of the lymphatics, and that's because of unidirectional valves that occur to allow movement from outside to in. That's a unidirectional valve, as well as from peripheral to central, we have unidirectional valves. So in both cases, pressure gradients alone allow it to come in and then move centrally. So one factor is interstitial pressure. As the interstitial pressure increases, it forces fluid into the lymphatic system. What is a rise in interstitial pressure? Well, we talked about this briefly on Friday, but this would be a common case of this would be like edema. Edema, when there's fluid accumulating in the interstitial space, such as when you're hypertensive. Talk about the example, if you're hypertensive, it forces the starling relationship in the capillary to be in favor of filtration as opposed to absorption. More fluid's going out than it's coming in. And if that's left it unattended, the fluid in the interstitial space will increase, resulting in edema, but also resulting in increased interstitial pressure, which increases the lymphatic drainage of that area. So it's playing an important role. And then as we move to larger sections of the lymphatics, so they actually have vascular smooth muscle cells, like arteries or arterioles, and these can contract. And one of the properties of them is myogenic tone, which we talked about in arteries. Myogenic tone comes about by increased stretch. So as we increase stretch of the vessel, in this case the lymphatic vessel, we get increased contraction. Whoops. And the contraction is due to an increase in calcium coming in through stretch-sensitive channels. So in the lymphatics, this is important, and as it contracts, it compresses the fluid within that segment of the capillary and forces it centrally because of the unidirectional valves. And we have something similar on the venous side of the circulation as well. And the other factor is, we left talking about this, compression of the lymphatics within a structure, such as when your legs are contracting, the gastric nemius and whatever, they're compressing the lymphatics, and just like they do for the veins on the venous side of the circulation, they force blood in the case of the venous side, and they force lymphatic fluid in the case of the lymphatic system centrally. Okay? All right, so this is a view of relative lymph flow. Remember, lymph flow is in the order of 2 to 4 liters per day, but can increase, and it's driven in part by the PIF, which is the interstitial fluid, or the pressure of the interstitial fluid. Okay, so if we start getting edemas, or edemic, we increase this value right here. Now, the lymphatic system is often ignored or underestimated, but the relevance and the importance of the lymphatic system is emphasized when something goes awry with it. I mean, the most obvious example is when you become sick with a viral infection or a bacterial infection and your lymph nodes swell. And then you become aware of your lymphatic system, become aware of your lymph nodes. And so that's an obvious case. The less obvious case is for example, with breast cancer and people having mastectomies, often lymph nodes are removed, particularly if the lymph nodes show positive stains for cancer. So in that case, and this is not just true for a mastectomy, but any case in which surgical procedures are used to remove a cancer and some of the lymph nodes are taken with it. Now, it's not usually discussed very much, but one of the problems is poor drainage and pain associated with that because of the absence of the lymphatic system. The lymphatic nodes are gone. A yet more striking example is a common occurrence in Africa where people get infected by a mosquito carrying larvae for worms, a particular type of worm, and it results in the disease called elephantiasis. Now, it's a little early in the morning for the next slide, so if you want to just close your eyes, go ahead. But there's millions of people in Africa suffering from this disease, and this is simply an obstruction of the lymphatic system causing very severe edema in the legs. This is the worm that's involved, and the disease is called elephantiasis because of the huge appendages that result from poor drainage. So once these people are affected, they have to be treated to remove the worm. It's a little bit like treating malaria afterwards. It's a bit tricky. Obviously, prevention is better, but you know those pesky mosquitoes carrying West Nile virus and a bunch of other things, this is one of the things they carry. And it shows some of the many problems that exist in Africa that are largely going untreated, including HIV and malaria, etc. This is one of them. Okay, so much for the lymphatic system. Let's move on now and talk about venous return. So we took a little side route now. We're back to the circulatory system. The lymphatic is a ancillary system to the circulatory system because it runs parallel to it, but it actually dumps into the circulatory system, so we could call it part of that. But venous return is a very important property of the venous side of the circulation. And it's a flow. And so like any flow, we can describe it by being Q equals delta P over R, which is just rearranging Ohm's law, P equals QR. And so now let's put in the appropriate values. The Q in this case is venous return. So venous return would be in liters per minute or milliliters per minute. So venous return equals to the driving force, the pressure gradients for venous return. And this is the part that gets a little bit tricky. So let me just draw the heart here. This is the right atrium right here. And the right atrium is filled by the, don't hold me to the anatomical correctness of my drawing, but the superior vena cava and the inferior vena cava, and they dump into the right atrium. And so for venous return, we're talking about the fluid that ends up in the right atrium that comes from the venous side of the circulation, either from the head and shoulders through the superior vena cava or from the rest of the body through the inferior vena cava. What am I doing with an S here? So the delta P here, the back end of it is the pressure in the right atrium. What's the driving force? Well, it's a value that's taken from an average of the pressure in the venous side of the circulation. And that's a pressure out here. And I'm going to tell you how this pressure is derived. It's a bit tricky. But we're going to call this pressure the systemic filling pressure. Or PSF. In the Byrne and Levy textbook, they call it mean circulatory pressure. Or PMC. And that's a pressure. Once again, I'm going to define this pressure a little more carefully later, or in a moment. But it's a pressure out here on the venous side of the circulation. And the other side of the equation is the pressure in the right atrium. So, on the top half, we have systemic filling pressure minus the pressure in the right atrium. That's the driving force. It's the pressure pushing the fluid from the veins into the right atrium. What's the resistance? Well, the resistance is largely the resistance on the venous side of the circulation to return. So if we constrict the venules or the veins in some way, then we change the resistance. We reduce the ability for blood to flow back into the right atrium. So this would be the resistance. I'll just put it venous resistance here. Okay? That's the basic thing. Now let's look at some figures. And these figures are taken from the alternative textbook by Walter Boron and the other guy whose name I can't pronounce. Oh, yeah, before I do that, I wanted to talk about the importance of venous return on our pressure volume loops. And these are the pressure volume loops. In the gray is the normal pressure volume loop that I drew on the board a couple weeks ago. And what's shown here are the effects of three different physiological changes on the pressure volume loop, and they're shown in some color, I don't know what it is, orange or pink or something like that. If we choose the middle one right here, this is the effect of increasing preload. And we can see it, it's very clear what is happening is the end diastolic volume increases. So we go from C prime, which is the pressure volume point that we saw before, this is the end diastolic volume, to this point out here. And this increase is due to an increase in end diastolic volume. How does end diastolic volume increase? Well, it increases because venous return is increased. More blood is coming back into the right atrium. Now remember, this is the left ventricular pressure volume loop, okay? But it's important to understand that as we fill the left atrium with more blood, if we increase venous return, we're going to increase the right atrial filling and therefore increase the pressure in the right atrium. We get more filling of the right ventricle and we get greater cardiac output from the right side of the heart. And that means an increase. So we're increasing the volume of the right atrium. We're increasing the volume of the right ventricle. It means we're increasing, after it goes through the pulmonary circulation, the volume of the left atrium, and that results in increased volume of the left ventricle. So by increasing venous return, we increase right atrial filling, and then it ripples through, and within a beat, we have increased filling of the left ventricle, which is what we're looking at here. Okay? So the factors we're going to talk about that influence venous return influence the end diastolic volume in the left ventricle. The first effect is increase the volume of the end of the right ventricle. Then as a consequence, we have the isovolumetric contraction phase ejection. And the bottom line is the stroke volume is increased. Point A to C is larger than point A prime to C prime, the original pressure volume relationship. So venous return can affect cardiac output, stroke volume more specifically, through the Starling relationship. So that's important. And just as a side note, because I didn't show this, and I probably should have at the time I did the pressure volume relationship, these are the other factors that increase that change the pressure-volume relationship. Changing contractility results in a decrease in end-systolic volume. Less blood is left in the heart after ejection because the heart is beating with more force, mostly because more calcium is being delivered, and this could be a beta-adrenergic-mediated system. So this is increased contractility. This is increased afterload. So this is preload, afterload. See, the increased afterload right here is requiring a greater amount of work done in the isovolumetric contraction phase. The heart has to eject, has to contract with greater force before the blood is ejected into the circulatory system, into the systemic system. That's an increased afterload. And if you simply increase afterload immediately, stroke volume gets decreased. And you can see the stroke volume right here is less than the stroke volume shown in the original pressure-volume relationship. And then there's some homeostatic mechanisms that we'll talk about that will readjust this, but the bottom line is with the increased afterload, the heart is doing a lot more work to get the same amount of blood out. Let's come back here. This is the increased preload. This is due to increased venous return. So it must mean that something here has been affected in this equation to increase the filling and therefore increase the ejection of blood. Okay, now if we look at this, this is figure 22.9 from that alternative text. It's on reserve in the library. Has anyone looked at this textbook in the library yet? No? We have a winner here. You looked at it, what do you think of it?
I like the other one better.
You like Vernon Levy better?
Yeah, the other problems are outlined better.
What's that?
The other one's more medical, like it's from a clinical standpoint, I thought. Like, the Vernon Levy follows your outline better. More relevant to your
lesson. Okay, Vern's dead. I don't think he's following anything I do right now. But yeah, I understand what you're saying. Maybe you could say I'm following Vern more. Yeah, okay. I think I'm still alive. But the other textbook has some better explanations. And for this particular section I'm going to talk about, don't read Vern and Levy. For this thing on venous return, ignore it completely. The Boron book is better for this. And Guyton, which I sometimes use as a backup textbook, actually is better yet. Guyton is the guy who developed this relationship. Guyton also passed away within the last couple of years. It seems like there's an epidemic within cardiac physiologists. The first part of the figure I want to show you, though, is in this upper left-hand panel right here. And this shows you the venous side of the circulation, you know, classically shown in blue, and the red side of the circulation. And it shows the capacitance. And you already know this because everyone answered this correctly on the midterm exam. Isn't that right, Penny? We got 100% correct on this. Everyone knows what compliance means, I mean. But compliance is the delta V over delta T. Okay? So the importance of this diagram is it's the relative scaling of these blood vessels to each other, the size of the blue relative to the size of the red. So, the blue is a little bit bigger. And it turns out that most of the blood, as we're sitting here, resides on the venous side of the circulation. 60 or 70% of it resides there. And it changes with the conditions that we'll talk about in the next lecture or two. One of the reasons it resides there is the very high compliance on the venous side of the circulation. We can get huge increases in volume with very little changes in pressure. Very high compliance. So the distensibility of the veins is an important aspect, and so they serve as a storage which can change. It can change the amount that it stores, and actually it can change the compliance. Okay. That's the first point I want to make. The second point here is this panel B right here, and it's a bit tricky, but this is the pressure in the right atrium. This is this value right here, P sub RA, is called RAP here. Bottom is hip hop. We got them all. No, this is, forget it. This is venous return right here. And what it's trying to show is that as right atrial pressure increases, venous return decreases. So at point B, we have a right atrial pressure of 7 millimeters of mercury. So right in here we have 7 millimeters of mercury, or right here this value equals 7, and when this value equals 7, venous return equals 0. Okay? Okay, this is, what is this? Grade 6 math. When this equals 7, this equals 0. Therefore, what is the value of this? Just amuse me, entertain me first. Anyone say 7? Okay, so if this equals 7, then that's the case. So, what they're trying to argue here is when the right atrial pressure is equal to a value of about 7 in a normal body, venous return decreases to 0, and the argument is that right atrial pressure equals the systemic filling pressure. This value, which I said is kind of nebulous and hard to define. Now, in panel C is the way we're going to look at this for the next few diagrams. This is venous return plotted as a function of right atrial pressure. And as the right atrial pressure increases to this value of 7, venous return decreases to 0. And so they call this in this book MSFP, or means systemic filling pressure. So we have a third term, but it's just this PSF. That's what it is. This is PSF. Okay. Now normally, well, you tell me. Normally, what is our venous return? As you sit here, what's the approximate value of your venous return? Right? And how'd you derive that? Exactly. So cardiac output is 5 liters per day? Yeah, 5 liters per minute. And you didn't get that by looking at this graph right here with the dotted line, right? Venous return has to equal cardiac output over the long haul. We can get minute-to-minute fluctuations or beat-to-beat fluctuations, but over the course of many minutes, they have to equal each other. That's very important. So at this point, venous return has a value of 5 liters per minute, and we can see that the right atrial filling pressure here, sorry, the right atrial pressure has a value of about 2. So the normal value of right atrial pressure is somewhere between 0 and 2. That's normal, but it can change. Okay, any questions on that? So this is called a vascular function curve. We have a curve where we have Q and R and we have a slope. And we've seen this before, Q and R. So the slope of this line is equal to, was that, okay, it's related to resistance. Is it purely equal to resistance? If you look at this equation, it's proportional to resistance, but resistance equals T over, whoops, how's that? So it's equal to 1 over R. Okay, so we have a couple of important values here. We have a slope of the line, we have an intercept, which is a theoretical value which reflects this driving force in the mean systemic filling pressure. Part of the driving force and the other half of the driving force is the right atrial pressure. Okay. I wasn't going to show this figure. This is from the Guyton textbook. I think I've got a... Yeah. Okay, this is back to the Boron book. So if you're going to read a textbook on the venous return, read the Boron book. Don't read the Byrne and Levy. I just want to emphasize that. This shows two fluctuations, two types of fluctuations or variations within the vascular function curve. Let's look at the left panel first. We have the blue line, which is the normal vascular function curve, has a systemic filling pressure of 7. And we have a green and a red version of it. And these are modulated by changing blood volume. We go to the red line with a transfusion, and just say we add 2 liters of fluid. It doesn't even have to be blood, but saline would do it. Blood would be better. As we increase the volume of the blood, we increase the pressure, and I'll show you this in a moment, I believe. We increase the pressure in the circulatory system in general, but we certainly increase the pressure on the venous side of the equation, and we increase the systemic filling pressure, or PSF. In this case, it goes from 7 to 9. The reverse is when fluid has been removed, or there's hemorrhaging, something results in a decreased blood volume, and in that case, the PSF is decreased to 5. Okay? So this is one way of varying the vascular function curve, is to change the blood volume. It's certainly not the only way. In the right panel, we have changes in arteriolar tone and also venous compliance, but I'll get into that later on. So in this case, we have in the red line, okay, let's go with the purple line. The purple line is the normal curve, just as it was in the left panel. So this curve is identical to that. If we vasodilate the arterioles, or if we change the compliance on the venous side of the circulation, what we see is the mean systemic filling pressure is unchanged, but the slope of this line is greater, meaning the resistance is less. And of course, that's what vasodilation is. By definition, vasodilation is results in a reduction in resistance, an increase in radius. We'll talk about how this is manipulated physiologically later on. The converse of this is to vasoconstrict. And when we vasoconstrict, same systemic filling pressure, but the slope of the line is less, reflecting increased resistance. or smaller radius. Okay? So these terms right here, the slopes of these lines are reflecting this term right here, the resistance to venous flow. Now it makes sense. As you reduce the resistance, you get more blood coming back to the heart for the same driving force. So if the driving force is the same, but the resistance is less, the venous return will increase. That's obvious. And conversely, as the resistance increases, the venous return will be less for the same driving force. So we can change the driving force, or we can change resistance. Both of these will affect venous return. Okay, any questions on that? All right, now the top panel right here, this is figure 2211 from the Boron book, is now imposing two functions, the first of which is what we just talked about, the vascular function curve. And I'm not even sure what color it is. I can't tell whether it's purple or black, but it's this line right here. It's the vascular function curve that we just drew. And superimposed on that is the cardiac function curve shown in red. Is this cardiac function curve reminiscent of anything you've seen before? It's what? You haven't seen this before? It's like lymph return, but it's not. It's identical to something we've seen before. It's a Starling curve. It's identical to the Starling curve. And this seems a bit tricky, but cardiac output, remember in the Starling curve we had stroke volume was proportional to end diastolic volume. Had this kind of relationship. Now stroke volume and cardiac output, the relationship between those two is pretty straightforward. As we increase stroke volume, we increase cardiac output for a given heart rate. This bottom line is a bit tricky though. The right atrial pressure, as it increases cardiac output. Why is that? Well, that's exactly related to the phenomenon I talked about before. As right atrial pressure increases right here, it results in an increase in end diastolic volume within a beat or two on the left side of the heart. So as this increases, meaning the right atrial pressure, the volume in the right atrium, it increases the right ventricular volume, which within a beat or two increases the volume in the left atrium and then the volume in the left ventricle. So this cardiac function curve now, instead of being expressed as a function of end diastolic volume, it's being described as a function of right atrial pressure. So that transition sometimes people find a bit tricky, but you can see the relationship between these two. Okay, so here's the cardiac function curve. This is a normal cardiac function curve, and we have an intercept point right here at A. And if we look on the ordinate, that value is 5 liters per minute. And so what that means is, at this point here, venous return equals 5 liters per minute, cardiac output equals 5 liters per minute. That's pretty good. Everyone's pretty happy about that. And this is called steady state. This is what we're normally doing at rest. But this can change. We change plasma volume, we get vasoconstriction, if we start exercising, many factors can cause this to change. The example that's shown here is shown right here, and let's see, what do they say? We're increasing the blood volume by, it doesn't say how much, but it's like a transfusion. So if we transfuse blood into the circulatory system, then we increase cardiac output, and we go from A to C. We go from A to C on the cardiac function curve because there's more blood coming in, and we get more cardiac output coming out there. Okay? Now, we're going from A to B. And as we do that, as we increase cardiac output, we're going to see a set of adaptations in which we go from B to C and C back to A, in which the body makes a series of adjustments. Because as we increase the cardiac output, and we increase the right atrial pressure as we've gone from A to B. Right atrial pressure has gone from 2 to about 5. What happens to venous return as we increase the right atrial pressure? What's that? I hear an increase. If you increase this term right here, what decreases? The driving force goes down, right? So with venous return, as we increase the right atrial pressure, we get a decrease in venous return. The blood's got to get back into a place that has relatively high pressure. And so then adjustments are made. As venous return gets reduced, cardiac output gets reduced and right atrial pressure comes down. So we have this instantaneous adaptation from A to B with the transfusion, and then a homeostatic adjustment going from B to C back to A, in which we now reach the status quo again, where venous return and cardiac output are equal, right atrial pressure is about 2 millimeters of mercury, and both venous and cardiac outputs are about 5 liters per minute. Okay? Now, the bottom line of these things are just, this example right here is what happens when we increase contractility of the heart. And when we increase contractility, remember the Starling curve gets shifted upwards and to the left. And so with increased contractility, we go from A to B, and B represents a point in which we have higher venous return, higher cardiac output. We've gone from 5 liters per minute to closer to 6.5 liters per minute, and the right atrial pressure has gone down somewhat. So the red line to this green line would be the effect. In this case, they used a cardiac glycoside. Your favorite cardiac glycoside may be wobane. But you would also see something similar if you add a beta agonist. But the beta agonist is more complicated because it has effects on the vascular system and can cause vasoconstriction, thereby affecting the resistance on the venous side of the circulation. Okay, so this is an easier example because this is a positive inotropic agent that doesn't have the effect on the vasculature that a beta agonist would. Okay, any questions on that? Straightforward? Okay, so much for that. We'll come back to the venous return and that type of circulation when we talk about the failing heart and exercise and some other factors which actually affect these parameters. But the next few lectures, we're going to talk about special circulations. We're going to talk about the heart in some detail, skeletal muscle relatively briefly because it's like heart in a lot of ways, the brain, the kidney, skin. This is very important. The skin regulation is quite different, and one of the reasons is that this is largely for regulating body temperature. And the kidney is quite different because the blood flow is going there not so much to keep the kidneys alive, which it is doing, but for dialysis, basically. So it has some special factors, and we're going to talk about the kidneys also in the context of regulating blood pressure. And then the last one is fetal, maternal fetal circulatory systems, how they are during gestation and how they change after birth. Some very dramatic changes which are crucial for the baby to live, both in utero and then once it's delivered. Okay, let's talk about the heart. So the heart is, of course, the coronary circulation. We're going to talk first of all about the anatomy of the coronaries, then regulation of myocardial oxygen consumption. So this is the Byrne and Levy text. These are the coronary blood vessels, and I think I've mentioned this several times. One of the important factors of the vasculature in the heart is that it's very rich. Remember, we have every myocyte has a capillary adjacent to it. So it's a very important characteristic of the heart because it's this high vasculature that allows for beta oxidation of free fatty acids, oxidation of glucose, and oxidation of lactate. Those three substrates are the three most important substrates in the heart. Of course, 70% is free fatty acids, but the oxidation of glucose and the oxidation of lactate both require oxygen. The heart doesn't produce lactate, it oxidizes. The heart usually uses glucose in an oxidative fashion rather than a glycolytic fashion. So if we look at the bottom panel, we see two important characteristics. Coming off of the aorta, the heart is the first organ to receive its own blood. So the heart is kind of egocentric in that way. I guess you could say it's grabbing the best blood that's coming out of the heart. And it's coming out of the aorta into left and right sides. We have a left and right coronary artery. So this is the aorta, and we have a left one coming out and a right one. The right one, you probably can guess, is feeding the right side of the heart, left to the right ventricle, right atrium. And since we're focusing mostly on the left side of the heart, for obvious reasons, We're going to talk mostly about the left coronary artery right here. Now, left coronary comes out, it's huge, and it branches almost immediately into two major arteries. The first one is the circumflex, and as the name implies, the circumflex goes around the heart, particularly the left side. Dropping off of the left coronary artery is, here they've called it the descending branch, but this is the left anterior descending. Or the LAD. It's a very important vessel in the heart, and it's known by cardiac surgeons as the widowmaker. It has a very nice ring to it. You like that? Your wife like it even more? I don't know. But the left anterior descending is called the widowmaker because when it's blocked, the portion of the heart that it's serving, the walls of the left ventricle, may fail, and as a consequence, cardiac output falls, and it can result in death. So this obstruction of this particular artery has a high correlation to high morbidity and mortality. So when we talk about coronary bypass, and you talk about quadruple coronary bypass, or triple or double, it's the number of coronary arteries that have to be circumvented or unblocked. But the LAD is the most important of those. So a quadruple may not be so bad, or a triple may not be so bad if the left anterior descending is intact. But if it includes the left anterior descending, then sometimes it's not such a good thing. Now, for all of these arteries, they come around, they go through capillaries, and then from capillaries they go to venules, and venules they go to veins, so the coronary veins, and they're shown a little better up in the top here. And then the veins, the coronary veins, enter into a structure known as the coronary sinus, which is right here. And the coronary sinus is where everything dumps into the, all of venous coronary circulation dumps into. And then returns into the heart, into the right atrium, to get oxygenated by the pulmonary circulation. Okay, so that's the anatomy of the coronaries. First thing you notice, highly vascularized. Second thing you should notice is two main branches coming off, and then the left side is the most important. I can't say the right side's not important. If you don't have a right heart, you're in trouble. But this is the left side is the one that is more often associated with, you know, high risk. The circumflex shown here, and the left anterior descending. All right, so now let's talk about coronary blood flow and its importance. Before I talk about coronary blood flow, though, I want to talk about why coronary blood flow is so important. Now, this part should be obvious to you because we talked about cardiac metabolism. And I just reiterated the point just a minute ago. All of the metabolism is oxidative. And if we don't have oxidative metabolism, we're really in trouble because the heart doesn't fare very well when it's trying to get produce ATP without oxygen. So, in order to do that, the heart has to have a pretty high level of oxygen consumption. Oxygen consumption we describe as the term V.O2, and in Mike's section of the course, you'll be going through this in great detail, talking about systemic V.O2. Now, I can guarantee you when Mike comes into the first day of lecture, he'll be telling you how, what a relief it will be that you can finally use the top half of the blackboard. But you notice that I'm actually reaching this high, so I've got about three, four. Mike can reach this part. I can't reach this part. So he'll remind you of that. But this equation right here that I'm going to describe can apply not only to the whole body, but also to the heart itself. And for the heart itself, we call this myocardial V.O2. And myocardial V.O2 is much higher as a percentage of the total oxygen consumption than is represented by the heart as a total percentage of your body weight. So the heart receives more oxygen, you might predict, simply from the mass of the heart. So my cardiac consumption, just like oxygen consumption for the whole body, can be described by the Fick equation. And the Fick equation tells you that the oxygen consumption is a product of the arterial venous O2 difference. That's one term. Times the flow. In this case, the flow is the coronary blood flow. What is the arterial venous O2 difference? Well, what's the normal oxygen content on the arterial side of the circulation? Anyone know? 205? Okay. This value is about 20 milliliters of oxygen per 100 mLs of blood. And again, in Mike's section, of course, you'll be talking about this in terms of oxygen saturation or oxygen association curves. As you increase the partial pressure of oxygen, you increase the saturation of the arterial side, and it depends on lots of factors. But normally you're sitting there with about 20 milliliters of oxygen on the arterial side. What's the approximate oxygen content on the venous side of the circulation? As you sit here right now, and if you were to take a sample of your venous blood, how much oxygen do you think would be in there? No clue? None? Okay, that's one vote. There's a little bit. We have any other votes? Did someone say 16? Oh, it's up to, okay, good. 16. It's 16. So if we look at mixed venous circulation, there's still a lot of oxygen sitting there, and that's the result of the fact that at rest, we're not extracting that much oxygen from the blood. The difference between these two is the extraction. And we can see that most of the oxygen has not been extracted. It's still sitting there. And the extraction here is equal to 4 milliliters of oxygen per 100 mLs of blood. But this value changes dramatically with exercise. If you start exercising, skeletal muscle, which represents most of the mass of your body for the average person, is extracting more and more oxygen so that the venous side of the circulation has less and less blood. This value of 20 milliliters of oxygen can't get any higher. It can get lower if you go to altitude, and get lower if you're anemic, and get lower for a variety of reasons. But for the average person, this value is staying roughly constant. But the venous side can get smaller and smaller. As the skeletal muscle becomes more effective at extracting oxygen because it's using more oxygen, this value can drop from 16 to 4 if you're running a marathon. In other words, extraction can increase. But as we're sitting here at rest, the venous side has a large amount of oxygen still in it. So this equation I'm describing right here, or these values I'm describing, are for the whole body. The heart is quite different, though. The heart has, on the venous on the arterial side of the circulation, also has a value of about 20 mLs of oxygen per 100 mLs of blood. It's getting the same blood as everywhere else. But if you were to take a sample from the coronary sinus, the venous side of the circulatory system of the heart, this value would be 4. So the bottom line here is that even as you're sitting, the heart is extracting as much blood as it can. We very seldom extract blood to the point that venous oxygen content goes below 4. Anyone know why? Anyone know anything about hemoglobin? From biochemistry, you probably should know this if you've taken... No? As you deplete more and more oxygen from the hemoglobin, it becomes more difficult to load hemoglobin onto it. Hemoglobin shows cooperativity of oxygen binding. So it seldom, under normal circumstances, achieves a value, the venous O2 content, achieves a value of less than 4. So the extraction, maximum extraction is about 16, the difference between 20 and 4, and the heart is showing that under resting conditions. Okay? So this value, if we go back to the myocardial oxygen consumption, this value is 16 milliliters of O2, that meaning the difference. Now, though, the body, or the heart, has to face different demands placed on it if you start exercising. And what you can see now, coronary blood flow, or I should say myocardial oxygen consumption, increases when you start exercising. There's no question the heart is doing more work. We talked about stroke work. If you increase the afterload, all those things require more oxygen because they require more ATP, and the ATP is being used aerobically. So, the bottom line is that if we want to increase the oxygen consumption of the heart, and we look at the sick equation, we cannot increase extraction. To increase oxygen consumption, we have to increase coronary blood flow. Okay, and so this relationship is like this. Myocardial oxygen consumption, whoops, let's put in the V, is related to coronary blood flow in a linear fashion. And if you want to increase the amount of oxygen that's consumed by your heart, which is important if the heart's doing more work, or else we get into a very pathological situation, we have to deliver more blood. There's no two ways around it. We can't simply extract more. So the next lecture, we'll talk about what regulates coronary blood flow. And now you see the importance of it, we'll talk about how it's regulated. Okay, any questions? No? Okay.